This is going to sound radical, I know, but what if? What if people making policy actually listened to the experts? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. It's Monday today, the 8th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Sometimes, and I know it's rare, but sometimes various threads in the news come together in interesting ways. And today, as you might have guessed, is one of those days. Last night, U.S. time, we got a new report on climate change, and it is bleak. Very bleak. A group called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, thousands of climate scientists basically, say the Earth's temperature has risen 1 degree Celsius, about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit if you do the conversion, since the Industrial Revolution. And if we can't keep that global warming below about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, oceans could rise an extra 4 inches, grain yields and available drinking water would plummet. It would be bad, as I said. It would also be, the group says, expensive, $8 to $15 trillion. Well, good thing then, and here's the other thread, that the Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded this morning to a guy who has spent his life marrying up environmental science and economics. William Nordhaus of Yale is his name. So, in his honor, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going with this what if. What if, ceteris paribus, that is, all other things being equal, what if we could see climate change and its solutions in economic terms?
Say you're at a dance of PhDs. And you force all the earth scientists on one wall to dance with all the economists on the other. That's what William Nordhaus has done. He asks, how does economic growth affect pollution and vice versa? USC economist Matthew Kahn.
Growth causes greater greenhouse gas emissions, but greater greenhouse gas emissions in turn lower economic growth.
For instance, climate change lowers crop yields and raises air conditioning bills. Nordhaus made models for policymakers to find the best approach to climate and economic growth.
Not because we're environmentalists, but to continue economic growth and the overall improvement in our overall standard of life.
In Bill Nordhaus's world, the optimal answer is a fee or a tax on polluters based on the damage they do. This is largely accepted in climate talks. So he changed the debate. To economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago, it's now less about right and wrong and more about math.
Without Bill's incredible work, climate change really could have become very firmly a moral issue instead of an issue that reflects trade-offs. And the problem with moral issues is that my morals aren't your morals.
But like any good academic, Nordhaus gets into fights. He thinks the world can handle a 5 degree Fahrenheit rise, which is much higher than many others. Economist Noah Kaufman at Columbia explains that's because Nordhaus assumes something about future generations.
People today don't care very much about what happens 100 years from now. And I think that's where there's a big disconnect between Nordhaus's model and the way that a lot of people who work on climate change see the issue.
This gets in the weeds of, quote, discounting the future, but it means a climate debate on an economist's terms. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Our theme today of What If continues with the second half of today's Economics Nobel, which went to Paul Romer of NYU's Stern School of Business for, to quote the committee, his work integrating technological innovations into long-run macroeconomic analysis. So, what if, once again, the people making the policy took Romer's work into account? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Paul Romer's big breakthrough was this. He took models of economic growth and added a missing magic ingredient.
Paul Romer put the production of ideas at the center stage of economic growth.
Ideas. Scott Stern teaches at MIT. Ideas are special. They're different from a lot of other goods because they don't get used up.
Either I eat an apple or you eat the apple, but we can all use calculus.
So sharing ideas, like the technology behind the internet, creates growth, but ideas also need to be protected, at least a little, to reward people for coming up with them. So you have things like patents on new drugs, for example. Romer put all of this together in a concrete model with a major implication. Chad Jones is a former colleague of Romer's and a professor at Stanford.
Economic growth is the result of these innovative efforts by entrepreneurs and scientists and researchers. And so anything that influences their effort can therefore affect our living standards in the long run.
Governments have the power to promote or discourage innovation through policy. Joshua Gans is a professor at the University of Toronto. He's known Romer for 30 years.
Paul Romer's work helped make the case for promoting science and innovation in ways that had not previously been possible.
And yet, maybe that message hasn't totally sunk in. Here's Romer at a news conference this morning.
I've been really disappointed that we just haven't had the kind of political environment where we could think about, you know, speeding up technological progress.
The U.S. government's share of all basic research funding in the U.S. is the lowest it's been since World War II. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A quick plug here for our interview with Paul Romer from a couple of years ago after he'd written a paper that said basically macroeconomists have been doing it all wrong. It's at marketplace.org. The link you need is mentioned on air. And yes, I know it's not technically the Nobel Prize in economics. Don't at me. Wall Street today, pretty good amount of bouncing around, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Crude oil closed basically even today, $74 or so a barrel for benchmark West Texas Intermediate. And given the way the oil market's gone for the past 5 years, the industry's going to take that. Oil and gas out in Kansas is mostly small independent producers. So even small changes in that price can have big economic impacts. And when the price crashed a couple of years ago, if you remember that, a lot of companies just stopped drilling and shut things down. But as Brian Grimmett of the Kansas News Service reports, oil on the rise has producers nervously starting to turn the pumps back on, which is affecting the rest of that state's economy.
I'm getting everything clean.
On a wet, misty morning in a field in western Kansas, three guys are working in a mix of mud and oil to pull pipe from a well with some broken parts. Tom Casey asks one of the workers, Luis Fernandez, for an update.
So what are you guys going to do here?
Well, we're running on the tubing anchor and tubing. We didn't find a casing leak.
Maintenance work like this is among the signs that the Kansas oil and gas industry is beginning to awake from its nearly four-year-long slumber. This crew works for Express Well Service that repairs oil and gas wells. They're slowly helping to restart an industry still anxious about recent losses. The company has a growing list of service requests. Tom Casey is a supervisor at Express.
Just thankful that we made it through that. Count our blessings every day that we're still here.
When profits tanked in 2015, oil companies turned off the pumps at many of their wells. That also dried up all the work for companies that service those wells. But that's changing. Casey says Express has so much work now, there's a growing backlog. And while he says he has enough rigs to get the jobs done, he's having a hard time finding enough people to work on them.
The unemployment office work with Hayes, Great Bend, and Salina, and they are all saying there's just not hardly anybody out there looking for a job, especially a hard job like ours.
Express is even offering to pay employee health care premiums as an incentive. Despite the staffing challenge, the glut of work is a welcome change for a company that had to lay people off and significantly cut hours a few years ago. In late 2014, the price of oil was more than $100 a barrel. But 2 years later, it bottomed out right around $26 a barrel.
Nobody thought it would last 3 years.
That's Jeremy Ulrich. He works in production for Sheck Oil.
Everybody thought it would be over in a couple, 10, 11 months. But once it hit that first year and then second year, it was tough.
Starting last year, oil prices have started to creep upwards, now touching right around $80. The rising prices have tempted many in the Kansas oil industry to get off the sidelines. The number of requests to drill new wells has been steadily increasing, from 141 requests in April to 236 in August. Kansas ranks 10th for crude oil production among the 50 states. Over the last decade, the state's oil and gas industry estimates it supported 118,000 jobs and generated $3 billion in wages.
It's time to get over the beating that we've had and go out and try our luck again.
That's Will Dara. He runs a small oil company based in Wichita, Kansas. In the first few years after the crash in oil prices, his company drilled only one new well. But this year, they plan on drilling 10. But even as the money and the oil start to flow again, the prospect of another price crash hangs over every decision companies make. And not everyone is as eager as Dara to jump back in. Take Scott Lawson of the Edmiston Oil Company.
We've decided to spend our money catching up on some of the things we chose not to do during the downturn.
He says that means replacing old inefficient pumps and fixing neglected pipes. So while he'll be turning back on wells that had been shut down, he'd like to see the price of oil stabilize longer before spending money on drilling new wells. In Wichita, Kansas, I'm Brian Grimmett for Marketplace.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a stop in Beijing this weekend on his way home from North Korea. It didn't go great. He had some blunt words with the Chinese foreign minister over trade and Taiwan and some other issues the two countries disagree on. And with the Sino-American economic relationship being chilly as it is at the moment, we've got another installment of our series, My Economy, about how people are dealing with things in their own personal economic day-to-day. Today, a businesswoman with a special interest in items 4202.21 through 4202.29 on the latest list of tariffed Chinese imports.
My name is Deepa Gandhi, and I am co-founder and COO of Dagny Dover. Dagny Dover is a handbag and accessories brand. We make a variety of products to really help a woman get from day to night. Everything is under $500. So if you compare our mid $200 price point bags to a Coach bag, for example, they would sell that probably at double. For me, I never felt a reason to buy a $1,000 plus handbag because I didn't feel that they were functional, right? I said, if I'm spending money, I want to make sure that this actually deals with my day-to-day. So we started with a product that has a place for your laptop, your water bottle, a key strap so you never lose your keys. When we first launched, we manufactured in New York locally, but we very, very quickly outgrew their capacity. Overall, handbag manufacturing in the U.S. is limited. You know, our average handbag is over, 100 pattern pieces. It's kind of crazy how complex they are. And you have to have multiple stitches, multiple edge paint, and, you know, things that just take a lot of time. And you need the labor force that actually is able to do that. And that labor force isn't trained in the U.S. And that's where Asia was really important. We are a small yet high growth business. So, you know, adding an additional tariff, we have to redo our cash flow planning and we have to rethink about how are we going to grow. If manufacturing was in the U.S., we could support the U.S. economy by bringing manufacturing here, but that's not an option for us. Our only option is to move to other countries in Southeast Asia. And we have actually been in the process of doing that, but it's still a matter of time because to properly shift a supply chain takes 18 to 24 months. These tariffs in the end will not just hurt us as a small business, but also the customer, because we have to start to think about, is this something that we pass along to our customers? And that's not something we want to do because it is still mid-price point. So we are confident we'll be able to weather it, but it definitely has us making some tough decisions.
This series only works when you tell us about you. So please take a minute, tell us how your economy is doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
So,
had we known it was related to radioactive stuff, we would have never done it.
It is tough being an intern in Japan, let me tell you. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's up 39 today, a 10th percent, close to 26,486. NASDAQ gave up 52 points, 6/10 percent, 77.35. The S&P 500 basically flat, 28.84. Tech took a fall. Microsoft down 1.1%. Apple down 0.2%. Utilities got a little bit to the good today. Duke Energy revived 0.9 percent. Consolidated Edison, Con Edison from back when I was a kid, rallied 0.4% today. Bond markets were closed for the Columbus Day holiday. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note stands at 3.23%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In the wake of security breaches and then hearings on Capitol Hill and then more security breaches, Facebook made an interesting announcement today. A couple of new devices, essentially video chat platforms, one called the Portal, a bigger one called the Portal Plus. And the big draw here is a camera that gets coupled with AI that can follow you as you chat, which, depending on how you look at it or how it looks at you, I suppose, is either really cool or really creepy. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. She is our go-to on tech questions like this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So who wants this, do you think? Who are they thinking about?
I mean, in a world where Facebook does not have the trust crisis that it has, this is really smart. I mean, this is a device that lets people have these really direct personal connections, in fact, more private than posting on Facebook. Yes. You could imagine if you were part of a Facebook group, like a book group, right? Or a little family group, that you could have a really nice video chat together. And then you have so many connections on Facebook that the idea to be able to easily connect with them and do this video chat would be great. We're still waiting for this in some ways. And actually, and this is surprising, it has a little more built-in privacy than, let's say, an Amazon Echo. You can turn off both the camera and the microphone. Facebook says this totally cuts the connection to the mothership. And it's worth noting, Bloomberg pointed out that when Amazon announced over 70 new devices and services last month, it didn't mention privacy once.
Okay. Yes, and point taken, however, comma, this is Facebook. And we are in a world where Facebook has the trust crisis that it has, right?
I have been operating a very informal survey on, ironically, Facebook-owned Instagram. 98% of respondents would not buy this, and it's more like 50-50 for a Google Home and an Amazon Echo. It's a really surprising announcement to make, for example, right after a hack, right after announcing that 50 million accounts were compromised. And a Pew Research Center survey from before that hack news said 74% of people were reducing their use or deleting the Facebook app or changing their privacy settings. I mean, you have to trust a company a lot before you let it put a camera in your house.
That's what I'm saying.
And it's a very confident assertion by Facebook, I think, that maybe people aren't worried about their privacy at all.
Which may well be the case, right, as we have talked about. Let me ask you a different but related question. It's kind of business model-ish, and it goes like this. Hardware is not Facebook's core competency.
Yeah. I mean, separate from all of that, I think it is very interesting that Facebook wants to get into the hardware business. It is tricky. There are low margins. It is hard to get right. You add a whole customer service layer that didn't exist before. You know, Google and Amazon both worked for years to get consumer hardware right. Google arguably has not yet, is only just starting to figure it out because it dedicated an entire division to it.
Yeah, Google Glass, anybody, right? I mean, that's where, you know.
It's hard. Right? Yeah. Hardware is hard.
Truly tough. All right. Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Talk to you soon. All right. We are going to do a pair of labor market stories in the bottom half of the program today. One here, one from overseas, both on the common theme of the completely foreseeable perils of historically low unemployment. In this country, as we learned on Friday, the jobless rate is 3.7%, the lowest in almost 50 years. Employers are having a tough time finding people, and that includes the federal government. The Census Bureau says it needs to hire hundreds of thousands of temporary workers for the 2020 census, which is going to be here before you know it. And it's not going to be as easy making those hires as it was last time round. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
10 years ago, David McLemore had just gotten laid off from a decades-long job as a newspaper reporter in San Antonio, Texas. Unemployment was high, and
there were not many jobs at all.
He spotted a sign at his unemployment office, and along with nearly 4 million other Americans, applied for a job as a temp worker around the time of the 2010 census.
There was a big demand for the work. There just weren't any that many jobs available.
10 years later, the census is reaching out again for field workers and others to help gather information. But it may be hard because the economy is in much better shape. The national unemployment rate has been low and fewer people are out of work. The census is already making videos to explain what it does.
Each decade, residents of the United States are asked to participate in...
And says it's planning to do extensive outreach by partnering with local organizations to publicize job availability, putting out public service announcements, using social media. But Rachel Franklin, a demographer at Brown University, points out today, gig economy jobs out there may pay better or offer more flexibility, like working for ride sharing.
You could be in your own car choosing what hours you work and when you work.
But a tight labor market overall doesn't mean a tight labor market everywhere. Julia Coronado, economist at the University of Texas at Austin, says the economic recovery of the last 10 years has been characterized by growth in urban areas. But in some rural spots,
they might have an easier time attracting the workers than in urban areas.
And in those rural areas, there are a lot of people to be counted. The census is already posting its county-by-county hourly pay rates for different states, hoping to entice workers with competitive wages. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You think 3.7% unemployment is tricky for companies in this economy? Try running one with the jobless rate at less than 2.5%, 2.4% actually, which is the state of the labor market in Japan. For every 100 people looking for a job over there, there are 160 job openings. Think about that for a second. That's thanks in large part to a declining birth rate, an aging population, and also a general wariness of immigrants in that economy. One response from the government, which is not without controversy: filling Japan's labor gap with foreign interns. Adrian Ma reports.
At a fish processing plant in Kamaishi, Japan, 26-year-old Win T. Dan is standing near a conveyor belt where a stream of silvery mackerel move by. One at a time, she grabs a fish and with a pair of scissors clips off the tail and fins. She's been working here for 2 years, but is originally from Vietnam.
It's a long way to come for a job.
I heard Japan is a wonderful country, so I wanted to experience it.
Tan is one of nearly 250,000 workers participating in what's known as Japan's Technical Intern Training Program. Officially, its purpose is to bring folks from neighboring countries and teach them skills they can apply when they return home after a few years. Yasuyuki Tsuda owns the fish plant. He says business is good, but Japanese workers are hard to find. So he hired interns. He says they're about 10% of his factory staff.
They not only feel the labor shortage, but they're very young, so they're energetic.
The intern program started in the 90s, and today more than 35,000 businesses use it. Even though it's billed as technical training, many say it's really a thinly veiled effort to fill jobs in a country where talk of immigration is political dynamite.
It's a warped way of trying to get laborers to come to Japan.
Ipe Tori runs a nonprofit in Tokyo called the Solidarity Network with Migrants Japan. He says a lack of oversight has allowed the program to devolve into a kind of indentured servitude. Every few days, he says his office gets calls from interns complaining of wage theft, harsh conditions, or even physical abuse from employers. He says it's not just a few bad apples.
The system itself is structurally wrong.
And there's some data to support that view. In 2016, the government investigated more than 1,000 companies that host interns and found nearly three-quarters of them in violation of some labor or safety law. Kazuyuki Kimbara is with a government agency set up last year to regulate the program.
My impression is that those who are critical of the program, they tend to exaggerate the problems.
He says serious violations are rare, and nobody is forcing people to come. Indeed, many interns willingly pay a small fortune to brokers in their home country just to get a spot. Win Ba Kong, who came from Vietnam a couple years ago, says he paid roughly $8,000 U.S. for a chance to make good money in concrete construction. But soon, he says he and other interns were tasked with doing radiation cleanup at sites affected by the 2011 meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant. At the time, he says his employer never explained to them what they were doing.
Had we known it was related to radioactive stuff, we would have never done it.
Kong has since left that job and is staying at a shelter for displaced interns. Despite his troubles, he says he wants a new internship and does not think the program should be shut down. Neither does the Japanese government. Right now, lawmakers are considering doubling the length of time interns can stay, from 5 years to 10. I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. The paper pointed out this morning some of the perks that Nobel Prize winners get. There is the cash, of course, A hair over $1 million this year, split however many ways the prize is split. Parking spots at their universities, always welcome, I am sure. Here, though, is the best one. After Niels Bohr of Denmark won the Physics Nobel in 1922, he was eventually given the house that the founder of Carlsberg, the Danish brewer, had left to be the residence of a notable Dane in the field of science, literature, or the arts. Here comes the best part. The house came with an inexhaustible supply of Carlsberg. It's a pilsner, but I'll allow it. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 39 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ gave up 52 points, about 0.6%. S&P 500 was basically flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.